Monster Man, episode 160, Beatles and Behemoth. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we're continuing our journey through the B chapter of Monster Manual 2, the 1983 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. The first monster on the list today is a category of monsters, and a category of monsters that also appears in Monster Manual 1, so I guess you can sort of think of these as further additions to that category. And that category is beetles. Beetles are great. Beetles are great because they're one of those creatures that you would have to make up if they weren't real, with their strange habits, their weird different ornaments, their cool iridescent armored shells. They're just terrific. It's easy to find fun facts about beetles that you can incorporate into your giant beetles, and big buckets of plastic bug toys are not hard to find or expensive, so the miniatures are cheap. Indeed, I assume that giant beetles, you know, or giant anything, probably come from, you know, having a big box of farm animal toys around somewhere. Anyway, the first beetle on today's list is the Death Watch beetle. Now, the real-life Death Watch beetle is a very small, boring, and not boring in the sense of uninteresting, but they bore into wood, and you find them in old houses where they, you know, sort of infest the woodwork, and they're known for making a very quiet kind of ticking sound. Hence, I guess, the name, the Death Watch, like that they're like a ticking clock, or you can only hear them when it's quiet, and it would be quiet during a Death Watch, a vigil, you know, as someone was about to die. In the giant Death Watch beetle, the sonic vibrations caused by this ticking sound are what cause people to die. Or at least to take damage. So it basically has a sonic attack. It also camouflages itself by sticking, you know, leaves and detritus and whatever to its carapace. I don't know if that's something Deathwatch beetles do, but it's definitely something that some insects do. I think the assassin bug camouflages itself with dead insect carapaces, which is particularly gruesome. I mean the assassin bug, the real-life bug, not the assassin bug, the D&D monster, which is something totally different. The Deathwatch beetle is fine. It does have another really extreme example of the writing style of this book, in which we are told that if you're trying to find the monster by sound, location of the monster thereby is 90% unlikely. Oh, Gary. Again, you know, not to play amateur copy editor on a book that's been out for 36 years, but oh, Gary. Next up, we have the Slicer Beetle. Now, the Slicer Beetle is terrific, and that's because it is a D&Dification of a thought that you probably had when looking at beetles. So you look at some species of beetles, and they have those great big mandibles, and you think, wow, if that were bigger, that could do you a mischief. That could take your fingertip right off, or whatever. I don't know if that's true or not, but they look big and sharp and dangerous. So we turn that into a monster where the mandibles really are big and sharp and dangerous. And what the Slicer Beetle likes to do is come up to you and snip your leg off with its mandibles. And then, because again, it's not here to have a fight with you, it's here to get some food. If it thinks things are going badly, it will grab your leg and scurry off back to its nest, hoping that you won't follow because now you've only got one leg. So this is a wonderful sort of image of a bunch of player characters chasing after this beetle like, hey, it's got my leg. And the section cannily suggests that one reason might be that, of course, your foot might very well be encased in a valuable magic boot. And indeed, when you go to, like, loot the Slicer Beetle's lair, one of the most common things that you might find are magical items that go on an arm, hand, or foot. And there are even rules for what happens if you only have one of a pair of magic boots or one of a pair of magic gloves. What happens when you have only one gauntlet of ogre power? Now, I don't know who this person was that had gauntlets of ogre power, but lost a fight with a Slicer Beetle. And you'd think that the person with the boots of elvenkind might have, you know, managed to sneak past the Slicer Beetle, but let's gloss over that for now, just because this is a great piece of, like, just a little minigame, doesn't take up much space, it's about a paragraph long, that goes in the description of this also fun monster. Slicer Beetles are terrific. Also, this is one of the cases where a certain amount of glee at maiming a player character feels okay, because there's just something so funny about the image of a giant beetle coming up and just snipping your leg off. Is more of a Warhammer kind of thing to happen, I would think. And, again, a very characteristic D&Dism where it essentially creates this weird critical hit system by the back door. So, on a roll of 19 or 20, the beetle snips your leg off, as opposed to having some kind of complex critical hit table that would really only apply to monsters like this one. It just sticks it in the monster manual description and doesn't worry about the fact that that might wind up being inconsistent with how limb severing appears in other things, because you're probably not going to be playing two limb severing monsters at the same time. This was derided as a design flaw, and in a sense I suppose it is, because it does mean that if your goal is to master absolutely every rule there's ever been for Dungeons & Dragons, that's an extremely complex and difficult undertaking. But I don't think that anybody thought that that was the goal, they just wanted to put all the stuff you would need to play this monster in one place, which I think is laudable. Alright, finally we've got the Behemoth. Some people say Behemoth, I've always said Behemoth. I'm not willing to, like, stake my reputation on that being the correct pronunciation. Anyway, what this is effectively a giant hippo. So, there are a couple of things to like about this entry, although, I mean, there's not much to it. Basically, the Behemoth is just a big hippo, and it's a bit like some of the monsters that we've already seen. For example, the Basilisk, Greater. This is here for DMs who want their players to have a fun hippo encounter while they're paddling their raft down the river, but are dealing with a party of players who would not be concerned about the presence of an actual hippo. It's great for all the same reasons that hippos are great, because you can imagine a hippo fight being actually pretty dangerous. I mean, they're big, they're powerful, they'll knock over your boat. Everyone knows the stats that say that hippos are more dangerous than lions. Of course, this is because humans spend very little time hanging out on the grasslands. Because why? But they spend a great deal of time on rivers, so they're much more likely to encounter hippos than lions. But also, the Monster Manual does tell us that a hippo is more dangerous than a lion, so that checks out. And so, you know, you can just imagine the Behemoth, like, lazily rolling against your mighty warship and knocking it over in the same way that a regular hippo might have lazily rolled against your canoe and knocked it over. And the king of this sort of pseudo-Egyptian nation would want to go out there and hunt hippos, or hunt behemoths, rather, with his, you know, magic lance to, you know, show off his power and authority. Perhaps they, you know, dwell in the placid waters around the temple of the hippo god, or hippo goddess if we're being Egyptian, lazily munching the river plants, but, like, not bothered by outsiders, so they don't really know what to do when you show up. Also, I like that this entry uses the word tush to describe the hippo's teeth, and then, you know, just expects you to know what that is. I had to look it up. But so they're fine. They're cool for all the reasons that normal hippos are cool. Although, I can also see some kind of aquatic creatures taming or domesticating them and then, you know, going into war with, like, howdahs on their backs. That would be kind of a neat opponent to have to fight. And again, you know, if you're big bucket of plastic safari animals doesn't have a hippo that's the right scale for your D&D game, then if it's too big, then it could just be a behemoth, right? I mean, waste not, want not. That's how turning cheap toys into miniatures works, right? All the little goblins up on its back, shooting reed arrows at people. Or maybe, I mean, given the, you know, the sort of hippo rampage, maybe it's not even that the goblins are taming them and mounting howdahs on their backs. It's that as the flotilla sweeps past down the river to the temple, the goblins are lurking in the reeds, giggling maniacally to themselves and shooting darts out of their blowguns and shooting arrows from their little bows at the behemoths to goad them into a stampede. It's hard to imagine that their darts could penetrate the animal's tough hide, so I imagine they're rubbed with some kind of irritant, you know, that's goblin chili or whatever, that they're using to drive these beasts into a frenzy. Or maybe they've just figured out what the behemoths don't like to smell. Do hippos have a good sense of smell? I have no idea. I once watched a nature documentary about the carcass of a hippo, and it was just like they just set up their night vision cameras and watched a dead hippo and, like, watched all the different animals trying to eat the dead hippo and failing because they just couldn't penetrate its hide. You know, they got some easy bits, and then they're just vultures desperately trying to get into this hippo's body so that they could eat all that delicious hippo meat, but, you know, their beaks just couldn't do the job. Which is representative. I mean, the behemoth is a pretty tough foe. So, seems like a pretty good, you know, big monster fight for a pseudo-African or similar landscape. You'd kind of have to explain why these things haven't just destroyed all of civilization by accidentally stepping on it, but, you know. I think you probably want to make it special. Like, that's Grandfather Hippo, the king of all hippos. Not King Hippo, who is different. But, you know, he lives at the, you know, in this one stretch of the river where no human ever dares venture kind of thing, rather than just being like, yeah, that's a behemoth. Don't act like you've never seen a behemoth before. That kind of takes some of the majesty out of it if it's just like, well, it's like a hippo, but bigger. Anyway, that is about all the time that we have for today. Please join me next time as we continue our march through the B chapter on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.